Immerse yourself in the lives of the BYU Cougars. This is Deep Blue.
This is Deep Blue with Jason Shepherd.
Thanks for tuning in to Deep Blue. This is the show where we get to know the person behind the number that you see on the field or the court. These are the true stories of BYU athletes from their own mouths. This is part two of my conversation with Elder Gifford Nielsen. If you missed part one of our conversation, you can find it on the BYU Radio app and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, part one focuses on the mission of BYU and his responsibilities when he served as a general authority for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In part two, we'll talk about his College Football Hall of Fame BYU career. We start this episode off by talking to Elder Nielsen about growing up in Provo, Utah.
Went to Wasatch Elementary, went to Fair Junior High School, went to Provo High School across the street to BYU. So the first 22, I'm not sure exactly how old I was when I was drafted, 23 years of my life was right here in Provo, Utah. I know this campus well because we would ride our bikes all the way through the campus, and we would come down here, play football on the lawn. We would do anything we could to go to any of the games, watch them. We had our favorite players. I had a dream upbringing as a BYU fan. My dad played basketball here at BYU, and so I've got five older sisters, five precious sisters growing up, and I was the youngest and only boy. So you can imagine my father, who's right. a former basketball yeah. player at BYU, and he has his own only boy. My mom used to say, okay, son, do you want my ticket again? I don't think she ever wanted to come to a game, but she always used to say, do you want my ticket again? Yes, I do. So I never missed games. I got autographs from all the former teams that would come in here, stand outside their locker room and just wait for them and get their autograph and get the BYU autographs. My dad was president of the Downtown Coaches Club. And so, you know, I was involved a lot early on in my life and just had the most amazing upbringing. Our house was crazy with five older sisters. And
were they older sisters, or did you have basically six different moms at different times?
Absolutely, yes, to answer that question.
Yeah, everybody wanted to take care of you, right?
Yeah, but my sisters were just absolutely amazing. But when I wanted a sandwich, they said, let me teach you how to make a sandwich.
Oh, there you go.
If I wanted a shirt iron, let me teach you how to iron a shirt. How to make a bed. You
know, life skills.
Yeah, I was taught life skills. And to make ends meet, this is interesting. Our house was called Maniac Mansion because we had so many people coming in and out of that house. My parents, in order to make ends meet, they both worked full time, but they fed 30 to 35 college students breakfast and dinner every day.
Every day?
Monday through Friday, they would come to our basement. And they were all wow. living in basement apartments up around the tree streets, and they would come to our house. So I always said I had brothers. I didn't have sisters, but I had brothers that would play catch with me, and you know they would. I got to go study, let's throw a couple of pass yeah. patterns. Let's shoot some more baskets. Let's hit some baseballs. Let's kick a. So I had brothers. I don't know how many brothers I've got. It was interesting when I played in the NFL. I'd be going around to different cities, and I'd behind the bench, I'd hear, hey, Giff. And I'd turn around, hey, Jerry, I haven't seen you for about 15 years.
Wow.
So it was just a dream upbringing.
So you've touched on your BYU fandom, and that's been there since you were, as long as you can remember. In terms of your own athletic pursuits, when did that start?
When I was born. I was always bigger than everyone, so I had an advantage, and I couldn't get enough of anything you could do with a ball. So if I'm going to throw it, shoot it, hit it, kick it, I wanted to do that. And I was a really gifted athlete. Not the greatest skills in the world, but I was just I had leadership qualities and just wanted to participate. And so we had an unbelievable group of my age group coming through the Provo school district. You know, we started at Wasatch, then we all kind of came together with other schools at Fair Junior High School, then on to Provo High School, and we were just a gifted group, and all we wanted to do was win state championships. That's all we were We were there to win state championships. We almost did it our senior year in football, lost the state championship in the stadium over here in the last 3 minutes of the game. Just crazy the way that happened. And then we went 27-0 in basketball and won the state championship. And that's what we wanted to do. Of course, we wanted to get our education, but we wanted to win championships. So it was – athletics has always been a big part of my life.
So why was basketball the first love? Because it sounds like it was basketball.
It was basketball.
So what about basketball really appealed to you?
Well, my father played.
Right.
And so, you know, if I could follow in my dad's footsteps, I wanted to do that. And then just gifted, you know, just knew how to play. And just with all of our friends, we would get together and play a lot of basketball. Played flag football coming up until we got to high school. And then we started playing organized tackle football. But it was always basketball was like the center of everything. It was even bigger. Basketball was bigger at BYU back then than football. That was very interesting. Right. We were known. Stan Watts' teams, NIT championship, you know, just different things. Like, I think they won the championship, the NIT championship. Yeah. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but I think they came close if they didn't. But it was always basketball, centered on basketball. And then football just kind of came along. And then it was just interesting how it turned because I came here and played 2 years of basketball, started some games my freshman year, started quite a few games my sophomore year, most of the games my sophomore year. And then Lavelle said, we're going to start throwing the ball. Let's go. And I'd played freshman football and then redshirted my sophomore year. So the 74 team, I was a redshirt. I went and played two-a-days with them and went to the 3 weeks into the season. Then I left and went and played basketball. And then they went and had that unbelievable year. But I was playing basketball right. that year. And so then I switched over and started playing football in 75.
How did you react when Lavelle comes up to you and you have that conversation and he's telling you, hey, maybe you need to go this route instead? What are you thinking at that time?
Well, it was an interesting time. I mean, we could sit here all day and just talk about that time and learn so many lessons from that. But I did learn a lot of lessons. But I prayed about it, thought about it, and the answer was clear, play football. And it surprised me, and it surprised everyone. And guess what, Jason? We started that year in 75, and I was terrible. I was not good. I didn't play the first game. Second game, I think, was Arizona State. I can't remember, but I got into the game at Arizona State, and they just pounded me. I was 4 out of 11 and threw a pass interception and got knocked out of the game. And I thought, I'm going to be moved down to the third-string quarterback. And the next week, I was the third-string quarterback. And it's kind of interesting how things turn around because I knew I was supposed to play football. And Lavelle's kind of looking at me like, what are you doing? You were supposed to be my quarterback. What is going on here? And it's interesting, once again, this is like, I got to be careful. Sometimes you have to go through adversity to figure it out, right? So I'm the third-string quarterback, and we're playing New Mexico, and we're 0-3, and everybody's calling for Lavelle's head. One of the jokes we always had is we were 0-3 and you were ready to get fired. Then you put me in and now you've got a stadium named after you. We always used to say that. And he goes, well, I took maybe the slowest quarterback in the history of the game and made him an All-American. So I got to be a pretty good coach. Anyway, we always joked about that. But it was the following week, Friday night. We played Friday night against New Mexico. They had the best team, I think, in the conference that year or one of the best teams in the conference. We were down 14-0 in the third quarter, and we were 0-3. And the first, Mark Giles, the starting quarterback, got a hit pointer. He was out. Jeff Duva was the second-string quarterback, moved the team up and down the field beautifully. He got to the 20-yard line every time, and something went wrong. So with about 3 minutes left to go in the game, Lavelle goes, okay, we're going to try you again. We tried you last week against Arizona State, and that was a failure. We're going to try you again. And then it just was a magical night. Magical night. Set a whack record that night, completing 11 out of 12 passes, and we came back and beat New Mexico, and that started it. This is how bad it was. So we're in that game, and everybody was expecting me to be the starting quarterback, or I don't know, I don't want to take anything away from Mark Giles and Jeff Duva because they were great quarterbacks, really good quarterbacks. But Lavelle was hoping that I would come and do this thing. And we got in the game and, you know, I was just failing. And so we're coming down the field. We just scored a touchdown, and Cougar Stadium started to wake up just a little bit because it was dead. Came down the field. We were on the 35-yard line, and Jeff Blank, a little fiery running back. I just love that kid. Comes in the huddle, and he goes, if you'll throw 70 throwback and just look to the left and then come back to the right, I'm going to be running down the right sideline by myself. I said, how do you know that? This is on the field.
Yeah, he's calling a shot.
And I said, I can't change the play. And Jeff Blank looked at me and said, what have you got to lose? What have you got to lose? Okay, I'm changing the play. What have I got to lose?
Right.
So I threw a 70 throwback. I rolled to my left, looked to the left, and then I looked back, and he was all by himself, 35-yard touchdown pass. And he came back and he said, told you.
Did anybody ask you why you changed the play?
Some of the coaches did, but they said, wow, okay. There was a lot of conversation about it. And then we kicked the field goal to win the game. And then after that, I was the starting quarterback. So through all that failure, it was terrible. It was hard to go to school. It was hard to live. It was hard. It was just tough. But then it turned. And now it's what it is today. Yeah.
We'll be right back after this. You're listening to the Deep Blue Podcast on BYU Radio.
Family, legacy, and Cougar pride come together on the BYU Radio podcast, Royal Legacy. Host Lauren McClain dives into the deep family ties that run through BYU sports. New episodes drop every Thursday on the BYU Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Deep Blue Podcast here on BYU Radio. My name is Jason Shepherd. Our guest today, former BYU quarterback and Emeritus General Authority for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Gifford Nielsen.
To what you said a minute ago, sometimes you have to go through adversity to figure it out, but then also to realize how good the good times are.
Yeah.
And you learned that lesson there because, needless to say, you probably were able to enjoy and realize how good things are when they were good.
Right. Yeah, so I had great, deep humility and appreciation. Everybody after the game was jumping around because we won our first game of the year, and everybody was, oh, yeah, and I'm thinking, wow, what just happened? 11 for 12, two touchdown passes. We came back, and now we're going. What just happened? And my heart was full of gratitude for sticking in there. And my dad just kept saying, stay in there. Be the first one on the field, last one off. Just keep working. I don't even know if you're ever going to play again, but just keep working and see if your time comes. And the time came.
Right.
And now, you know, what happened, with Lavelle and how he got Doug Scoville in here, and that changed everything.
How aware, not just you, but the program in general, how aware were you guys at the time that you were changing the landscape of college football offenses? I mean, it's something that had started and you guys just carried that through and built on it. How aware of that at the time were you?
So let me just lay it out to you, okay? Because everybody in the country was running the wishbone and the veer. It was a run-oriented offense in America.
Yeah.
And there were a few people dabbling in the passing game. Bill Walsh at Stanford. Jack Thompson was a quarterback at Washington State. So not too many people were doing it. But as the story goes, Lavelle wanted to throw the football, called Bill Walsh, who was the head coach at Stanford, said, have you got anybody that I can hire? Yes. Doug Scoville just got fired as the wide receiver coach for the San Francisco 49ers. If you can hire him and give him full control, you're going to change football. But you can't hire him because BYU doesn't pay anything. And that was Lavelle's genius. Somehow Lavelle was able to convince Doug Scoville to come and bring the West Coast offense. San Francisco gets credit for it because they won the Super Bowl.
Sure.
West Coast offense started at BYU in 1976. That's when it started in college football. And everybody was watching it. And we had a tremendous advantage. I'm not saying that we were better than everybody, but we had a tremendous advantage because nobody had seen all of these passing combinations. And they were trying to grapple with it and trying to figure it out. And we had it. Doug just had me schooled and drilled and had Mark Wilson schooled and drilled and had Jim McMahon schooled and drilled on this offense. So, you know, people say, okay, we lost our quarterback. What are we going to do with Bear? He's only, well, I said, when I went to practice, the guy backing me up was the number one draft choice of the Oakland Raiders. And the guy backing us up was the number one draft pick of the Chicago Bears. So every day at practice, I couldn't take a day off. I couldn't take a minute off. I couldn't take a play off because I had guys behind me that wanted, that's when you know you've got a great football team. And that's what Kalani is building right now. So when we started to throw the ball around, people had no clue. I'd come up to the line of scrimmage. There are times when I'd come up to the line of scrimmage and I said, in just about 10 seconds, this stadium's going to go crazy because this is a touchdown.
Yeah.
There's no way they can, with that defense, right? There's no way they can stop this play. And that was the genius of Doug Scoville.
We can't move on. We've mentioned his name too many times to not sit in it for a minute. And we could probably do an entire podcast just on this one question.
You could.
Lavelle Edwards means so much to everybody. You certainly have a personal relationship with him and a long history with him. Can you even put into words what that relationship meant and continues to mean to you?
Very hard to do because it was one of the most iconic relationships I could have ever had. We didn't know what we were doing. Okay, so we had a thought that this is what we were going to dream about doing, and he had some success with Gary Scheide and the 74 team, and Dewey Warren was the offensive coordinator. But it wasn't the offense that we were going to be running. And so Lavelle, to his credit, committed to a passing game, not knowing if it would ever happen. And so that's the genius of Lavelle. He committed to something, and he was going to stick with it, and he was going to get the best. There were only a few people that knew about Doug Scoville and his offense. And one of them was Bill Walsh. And he was watching it very carefully. And I didn't know this, but Buddy Ryan, a great coach in the NFL, was a very close friend of Doug. And so Buddy had the 46 defense that they won the Super Bowl with the Bears. And Doug had the offense that nobody knew what to do with. And so to Lavelle's genius, as a young coach, he says, I'm going to commit to this after having Pete Van Valkenburg his first year as the leading rusher in the country. But he said, I can't do this. I've got to do something different. That's the genius of Lavelle. And then he stayed principled. He stayed right down the line. He said, I'm not deviating from this, and I'm going to keep Doug here. I'm going to give him full control and let him go. And Lavelle did that and protected him and watched over him. And Doug left. Went to Cincinnati for 1 year after I left, and then came back and had Mark. And I don't know how they ever got Jim McMahon to redshirt, but had Mark as an All-American quarterback. So it was me as an All-American quarterback. Mark as an All-American quarterback. Jim as an All-American quarterback. Our tight end coach was Norm Chow. Norm sitting back listening and watching everything about this offense for about 5 years, because eventually he was going to get it, but he was just watching this. And Doug had... he had the offense, and that's the West Coast offense. And Mike Leach was even watching
it. That's right.
He was in the bushes. He was, seriously,
yeah,
he was
sitting about
in,
it.
He's sitting in the bushes watching. The first time I ever met Mike Leach, he goes, I've seen every play you've ever run. Every play you've ever run. And he said, I just took that offense. I took one of the running backs because I couldn't do exactly what we were doing here, put him in a slot, got more speed because I could recruit more speed in Texas. And then I just ran the air raid offense from the BYU offense. And that's, I mean, you just, the stories like that are just, we could sit here and talk about that for days.
When did you realize that you had the ability to play at the next level, that the NFL was a reality for you?
I think it was probably in my junior year, my All-American year, because I just felt like, the way I was schooled by Doug and reading defenses, I said, I could take this to another level. Doug used to always say to me, though, you're not ready yet. You're not ready yet. You're not ready yet. He used to say that all the time. But you're getting close. But you're getting close. Because it was
enough to just make you want to keep working
He was never going to give me the...
Right.
He was always going to force me to continue to go. But then he said, you're ready. You can handle this. And then I got hurt.
Right.
And then,
how devastating was that?
Tough. It was just hard because I was the leading Heisman Trophy candidate. We were the leading scoring team in the country, I think, at that time, the leading pass offensive team in the country, leading offensive team in the country. I mean, scored more points than anyone in the country. We were number one in every category, and it was just flying. And then to have it gone just like that teaches you an important lesson that you are just only as good as the next play. So don't keep thinking you're really something special. Do not think you're something special. You're just schooled to do this. Just keep doing it. Stay humble and stay focused and keep going.
I'm sure you get asked this all the time. Is there a moment on the field or a game specifically that stands out beyond anything else?
Yes. Two of them.
Okay.
We had to beat Arizona and Arizona State. We had to do that. And they were both very good teams. But we were in the WAC conference. And we went to Arizona and we were playing down in Tucson. And about 2 or 3 hours before the game, they must have had 10 inches of rain. I don't know. It was just like buckets. The field was perfect and it accepted the rain. So we did not play in a mud game. We played on a grass field that stayed grass. But it was wet and the balls were heavy and wet. And everybody talks about the SMU game. This might have been the best one. This might be better than that. But we had to beat Arizona, and we had the ball with about 10 seconds left to go in the game. And this is Doug. This is the brilliance of Doug. We were behind by 4 points, 43 yards from a touchdown, and he said, here's what I want you to do. Called timeout, went over the sideline. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to come drop back. I want you to stay in that pocket for a minute. Then I want you to step up. Then I want you to get to the right as fast as you can. I'm going, how do you know this is going to happen? You got guys flying all around you. He said, do that. Drop back, step up, get to the right. And then he said to Mike Cronister, you go down the left side, come across the field and head for that pylon. And then George Harris, you just go out here and then just head down. You look at Cronister and then you throw it back to George. And I did that. And I threw the ball and it kind of slipped out of my hands and kind of sailed up there and landed perfectly in George Harris's hands for a touchdown. And that might have been better than Clay Brown and Jim McMahon, but nobody knows about it.
Right.
Right? But it was a perfect play. And I just thought, you are brilliant. How did you know, Doug, that this is – how did you know? And he said, I knew.
That's the genius of Doug Scoville.
That's the genius of Doug Scoville. And then he came back against Arizona State, and they were a top 10 team. I mean, they're coming here, Frank Cush and all of them, and we had to beat them. And they came in here, and he put together the most brilliant game plan I've ever seen, even in college. I mean, even in pro ball. Mm-hmm. He had regular formation, then he put in the orange formation, and he told me exactly what was going to happen in this orange formation. And at the end of the first quarter, it was 21-20. And we beat him 42-21 or something like that. And those were the two pivotal games that this program needed to win in order to keep growing. I didn't have my center, Chuck Carlson. Bless his heart, he was 5'2 and weighed 215 pounds. That was my center.
Things are a little different
and
these days.
And he was so fun. And we loved Chuck Carlson, but it wasn't some guy 6'5, 310. But Chuck was just, we were just little battlers. Well, today you have to have an offensive line where they're all 300 pounds, and you have to have a defensive line. We didn't have that back then. We had skilled receivers. I mean, Todd Christensen became one of the great tight ends in NFL history, and he was my fullback. Brian Billick won a Super Bowl, and he was a tight end. And Mike Cronister and George Harris and Vanderwooden and we just had Van Leeuwen. We just had players that Jeff Blank just had players that were going to be okay. But, man, they've got talented players now that probably – well, I can't say they're more talented than us because we were pretty good.
Right.
We were pretty good.
You've mentioned a couple of times that you ended up being drafted by the Houston Oilers,
yes.
Third round. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Third round to the Oilers. What was your NFL experience like?
Classic. It was classic because it was interesting because I was the leading candidate for the Heisman Trophy mm-hmm. before I got hurt, and then I'm out. Houston had to take a chance on me. And they drafted Earl Campbell from the University of Texas. And Earl wasn't really playing very well in the first part of the season, but then just came on and just was amazing to win the Heisman Trophy. So Houston got the two Heisman, the winner and the guy that was third in the voting the year before. And so to go to Houston with Earl, was amazing. To be with Bum Phillips was amazing. So I didn't play the first couple of years. I was just backing up Dan Pastorini, and Pastorini was at the prime of his career. And we went to the AFC Championship for two straight years, playing the Steel Curtain, trying to beat the Steelers in Pittsburgh, which is impossible. Yeah. Played sparingly, and then had a couple of shoulder problems that kind of kept me back. Played 6 years in Houston, had the most amazing experience with Bum. My coach was named Bum.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And Texas legend, had unbelievable experiences with him and with the rest of my team. And so three unbelievable years, and then they fired Bum, and you don't do that in Texas. Yeah. And we just went straight off the table. It was the worst thing in the world. Three of the greatest years we could have ever had, and then three of the really hard years, and they started over with Warren Moon. So it was it, but my pro career was not, didn't play very much, but had an amazing experience.
How did the broadcasting opportunity present itself? And was that something that was ever on your radar prior to?
No. So that's amazing. I mean, if you look at my life, I never was going to play professional football, never was going to be a broadcaster. But the television station came to me in that after my sixth year and said, we don't have a sports guy and we want your name and reputation. And I went, well, what do you do? And they go, this is what you have to do. And I once again put it to prayer again. It was an interesting experience to put this to prayer. And I came back from, actually, I was going to Casper, Wyoming to speak at a fathers and sons commemoration devotional. And I just said that weekend, I'm going to put this to prayer, fasting and prayer, and decide what I'm going to do. Am I going to go tell the NFL I'm done? And what are they going to say? And take this job. I was offered this job as the sports director for the CBS affiliate in Houston, a top 10 market. I didn't even know what that meant.
Right.
And it came very clear to me that you're supposed to retire. I could have sat there behind Warren and played for a few more years, but I was ready to move on with my life and took the job at Channel 11 and was there 25 years. And they taught me how to do it. I mean, they have blooper reels of me on TV because they just threw me in there. And then they'd send me to Dallas to school to learn how to be an anchor.
Yeah.
And then I'd come back and try it a few times. And then they'd send me to Dallas again. I'm thinking, why do you keep doing this for me? And then 25 years later, we became like the number one CBS affiliate in the country. I think even stronger than KSL.
Than KSL. Wow.
Because KSL was the strongest local CBS affiliate all around the country. It wasn't a top 10 market, but KHOU, the spirit of Texas, we eventually did accomplish that.
All right. Well, let's bring this back around full circle as we wrap things up. After you retire, when did you get the call to be a general authority, and what was that moment like for you?
Well, it was after I was done with television and actually opened up a bank. I had five guys that I really liked that were my friends, and they were five really strong business people, and they said, we want you to be with us to open up a bank. And I went, a bank? And they go, yeah. I said, I don't know anything about banking. They go, we want your name and reputation.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, this name—
It's a common theme.
Name and reputation is so vital. That's why BYU athletics has to be so good. We can't be mediocre. We've got to win. We've got to be part of the conversation. I want your name, BYU, and I want your reputation. This is what you stand for. And so that's kind of been my life. And so we opened up a bank, and I'm opening up this bank, and then we have it open, and it's going great. And then I get this call that Elder Perry wants to talk to me. So we talked to Elder Perry, and then he goes, well, the First Presidency wants to talk to you. So then we got a call with President Eyring. And at that time, President Monson had just announced the change in the age of missionaries. Mm. So there were going to be 50 new missions. And when we got the call, I'm thinking, honey, we're going on a mission. And when they opened it up and said, the Lord is calling you to be a member of the First Quorum of the 70, I went, you sure? And he goes, and then President Eyring, in his very tender, beautiful teaching way. Taught us for about 45 minutes without us really saying anything about how the Lord works and how he calls. And we got done. It was a Zoom call. Can you imagine a Zoom call with President Eyring? And he just laid it all out. Don't question it. Don't think too much about this. But this is what the Lord wants you to do. And wow. Yeah. Go wherever they send you. So we had amazing experiences.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for being willing to do this. I have thoroughly enjoyed this, and I have enjoyed the spirit that you have brought in and feeling of that as much as I enjoyed talking about the sports side of everything. Thank you so much for being willing to do this and sit down with me. This was so much fun. I really do appreciate it.
So in closing, let me just say this.
Please.
Jason. Okay. What we're doing here at BYU is so important. And these coaches know how important this is. And the players are starting to understand how important this is. Because if Jesus Christ is going to perform some of his greatest work between now and when he comes again, everything we do has to be excellent. It's not to say we're going to win every game. We got to have a lot of patience with Bear right now, young quarterbacks or young players or whoever steps in. But we just have to be relevant. We have to be part of every conversation, because what we're doing is we're opening doors to prepare for the second coming of our Savior Jesus Christ. And everybody has a role to play. So we have to be good. We have to be excellent. And that's why I'm so passionate about everything happening here at BYU, and know that we have the right people in place to make that happen. I want to just say this. Tom was an unbelievable athletic director. We all know how well he did and negotiated all the way through COVID and everything else. I am a total Brian Santiago fan. I think Brian's got the capabilities to take us to the level that we need to take to make sure that the coaches are taken care of and the athletes are taken care of. And I just feel like that everything's in place for this thing to blossom under the leadership of Brian Santiago, the leadership of Vice President Keith Vorkink, who has that responsibility over athletics, and then President Shane Reese. I just think BYU is just primed to continue to be something very special, and it's going to happen.
Could not have said it any better. Elder Nielsen, you are amazing. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
You bet. Jason, thank you.
Thank you so much. My name is Jason Shepherd. Ben Hall produced this episode. Deep Blue's senior producer is Cleon Wall. You can download and subscribe to Deep Blue on all podcast platforms or find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.